Welcome to the Spellman Report Phytopharmacology Review. In our new research section this month, we will cover yet another study on sleep. This time, instead of cannabinoids, we will look at Crocus sativus, or saffron, in a double-blind, placebo-controlled, randomized trial. In our topic of the day, we will continue from last month on the MOAs of botanical medicines. And finally, we will continue our excellent interview with Guido Massé, an outstanding herbalist who has his roots not only in clinical phytotherapy, but in the production of medicinal plant remedies. Let's turn to our new research section. And this study we're going to be looking at is by Lopresti et al., entitled An Investigation into an Evening Intake of a Saffron Extract, that's Affron, which is a proprietary standardized extract, on sleep quality, cortisol, and melatonin concentrations in adults with poor sleep. A randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled, multi-dose study. And that's in SleepMed 2021, volume 86, pages 7 to 18. This was a three-arm parallel group 28-day clinical trial. And the interventions were saffron in the placebo group, and the tablets were identical in appearance, being matched for color, coating, shape, and even size. The active ingredient comprised a standardized saffron extract known as Affron, and that's put out by PharmActive Biotech Products SL, which is derived from the stigmas of Crocus sativus. The active treatments contain 14 or 28 milligrams of Affron, which is standardized to contain more than 3.5% leptocrosylides, a measure of bioactive compounds present in saffron, including saffronol and crocin isomers. So the three arms were the placebo, the 14 milligram group, and the 28 milligram group of the Affron. Now let's look at interventions. All the participants were instructed to take one tablet daily, 1 hour before bedtime, with or without food for 28 days. Tablet adherence was assessed by asking participants to provide a tablet count every 7 days. Treatment blinding was assessed by asking participants to predict group allocation. That's placebo, saffron, or uncertain at the end of the study. The inclusion criteria, both male and female, physically healthy participants aged 18 to 70 years with self-reported unsatisfactory sleep lasting longer than 4 weeks. Volunteers had a body mass index between 20 and 35 and a usual bedtime between 9 p.m. and 12 a.m. Participants were fluent in English and consented via an online consent form to all pertinent aspects of the trial. Now, the exclusion criteria included participants that had night shift work, rotational shift work, or experiencing internal factors that may affect their sleep patterns, such as children regularly waking, excess noise, snoring partners, pain conditions, as well as people experiencing sleep disorder other than moderate insomnia, and then being diagnosed with a mental health disorder other than mild depressive or anxiety symptoms. Consuming more than 3 cups of coffee per day, I like that they actually did that. That would include energy drinks, tea, other caffeinated beverages, or an alcohol consumption greater than 14 standard drinks per week were excluded. The participants were also ineligible for the study if they were taking a pharmaceutical medication or natural supplement that may affect sleep quality, or already taking saffron supplements, receiving non-pharmacological treatment for sleep disorders, or had a current or 12-month history of illicit drug use, or had recently diagnosed or unmanaged medical condition, but not limited to diabetes, hyper or hypotension, cardiovascular disease, GI disease, gallbladder disease, endocrine diseases, neurological diseases, including head or brain injury, or acute or chronic pain affecting sleep. Pregnant women, women who are breastfeeding, or women who intended to become pregnant were also ineligible to participate in the study. The outcome measures they used were based on mainly questionnaires, but we'll get into some of the biochemistry that they did. So they used the restorative sleep questionnaire. There's a weekly version of that, which they used. The insomnia symptom questionnaire, also known as the ISQ, the functional outcomes of sleep questionnaire, the short version, that's known as the FOSQ-10, and the profile of mood states, abbreviated version, and that's the POEMS. And these were completed online. The primary outcome measure was the Pittsburgh Sleep Diary sleep quality rating. And the secondary outcome measures were the questionnaires and diaries that I just mentioned. Now, they also did salivary cortisol and melatonin in the evenings. And to measure salivary concentrations of cortisol and melatonin, participants were provided with small collection tubes. Saliva was collected by unstimulated passive drool. The number of subjects were 120 volunteers that started. However, questionnaire and diary data from only 102 participants were returned, and this was used for a statistical analysis. So what are our results? Well, compared to the placebo, there was a statistically significant between-group difference in change in the PSD, that's the Pittsburgh Sleep Diary, sleep quality ratings between the saffron and placebo group, but no significant difference between the two saffron doses. So that's interesting. Participants supplemented with saffron experienced greater improvements in sleep quality ratings, mood ratings after awakening, and the ISQ, which is the insomnia symptom questionnaire, total score. Insomnia classifications based on the ISQ also revealed that saffron supplementation was associated with a greater reduction in the rate of insomnia. That was about a 24% reduction compared to the placebo, which was about a 6% reduction. However, there were no significant differences between the saffron and placebo groups in changes in self-reported alertness ratings after awakening, total sleep time, time to sleep onset, the number of awakenings after sleep onset, and restorative sleep, and quality of life as associated with excess sleepiness. There was also no between-group differences in mood-related changes as measured by the POMS, the Profile of Mood States questionnaire. Now, group comparisons revealed that changes in melatonin concentrations were significantly different in the combined saffron groups compared to the placebo group. Melatonin concentrations from baseline to day 28 significantly increased in the combined saffron groups, but there was no statistically significant change in the placebo group. The saffron 14 milligrams or saffron 28 milligrams group, a statistically significant decrease in cortisol concentrations from baseline to day 28 was identified in the combined saffron groups and saffron 28 milligrams group, but these decreases did not differ significantly from changes in the placebo group. No other statistically significant within or between groups differences in changes in salivary hormone concentrations were identified. Now, what about adverse events? There were no significant differences in the frequency of reported adverse effects between the groups, and no serious adverse events were reported by participants. There were no reports of any adverse effects in 82.5% of participants in the placebo and saffron 14 milligram groups and 87.5% of participants in the saffron 28 milligram group. However, one participant in each saffron group did report withdrawing from the study due to headaches and migraines. And this adverse effect, interestingly, has not been identified previously in trials on saffron. So that is something to watch for in the future. Now, based on the ISQ classification, approximately 57% of people recruited in this trial fulfilled the criteria for insomnia. In future trials, it will be important to include objective sleep measures such as polysomnography, actigraphy, or even wrist-worn commercial sleep trackers. These are all devices that will really give us more insight into any of the sleep remedies, whether they be pharmaceutical or botanical medicine-based. Now, 70% of the participants were female. The mean age was 52 years. Consequently, many participants were likely peri or postmenopausal, which will influence the generalizability of the findings to other populations. A future trial should also substratify by gender. It will also be nice to control for dose a bit more through substratifying by BMI. In this trial, the BMI range was quite wide, between 20 and 35. And that would have an effect on serum concentrations. Generally speaking, I find that most clinical trials need to substratify more, and I'd love to see it in terms of constitution, even something as basic as ectomorphy, mesomorphy, and endomorphy. Now let's turn to our topic of the day. Today we're going to talk about the energetics of herbs. And if you're confused by that term, keep in mind that we're going beyond chemistry, biochemistry here, and literally talking about the effects of herbs on the body in a different way. But before we go there, I just want to touch on something that will become relevant. About 80% of the globe's population is still using medicinal plants for some aspect of primary care. These plants are used in traditional systems that view the energetics of the disease and then commonly match the balancing energies from a food or a plant as a modality of treatment. Since 75% of the discoveries that led to new pharmaceutical drugs for medicinal plants are led by traditional use and knowledge of the plant, this strongly suggests that energetic models provide a model of knowing that holds, at the very least, some accuracy that overlaps with biochemical understanding of pathology and pharmacology. The difference seems to be one of perspective and language. Just because a traditional healer or herbalist can't speak of the chemistry of a plant or the biochemistry of a human disorder does not mean that they do not have effective tools for addressing human suffering. Under non-Western systems, foods and herbs are often described not in terms of biochemical activity, but in terms of properties of hot or cold, moist or dry, grounding or dispersing, subtle or gross, etc. The actual terms used may vary depending on geographical ecosystems and language, but the meanings are essentially the same. Cold conditions typically demonstrate qualities of freezing, congestion, and solidification deep within the body, such as joints, muscles, and lungs, with little to no signs on the outside of the body. Rheumatism is considered cold, manifesting in the joints. Cold in the respiratory tract and lungs expresses coughs, colds, asthma, breathlessness, bronchitis, and TB, and tuberculosis, that is. But of key cultural and philosophical importance in regard to health, the hot-cold model empowers the common person with an understanding of how and why disease has occurred and how to counter the effects of disease by the use of surrounding substances, metaphor, and analogy. The understanding of why disease occurs is not in the hands of specialists, but in the hands of the people. Nevertheless, within indigenous cultures, a specialist is sometimes sought out for therapeutics and further explanation in severe cases. Cultures using binary characteristics, such as hot and cold, evaluate the physiological effects of food and medicines in particular contexts, and so certify their classifications for future reference. Thus, this model derives from the pathways of tradition, personal experience, and intuition. Even today, although modern medical science is creeping in, folk medicine in Asia, Latin America, and South America still embraces a hot-cold causation as playing a central role in many diseases, even though other etiological factors such as hereditary, contagion, germs, water, and evil spirits are also seen as causing disease. Characteristics, the energy of a substance, activity, and her situation are still believed to be causative factors in both health and disease, and as a result, many of the humoral models are integrating modern culture, products, and medicine. For instance, canned foods, ice cream, Coca-Cola, and pharmaceuticals have been incorporated into energetic classifications. These exogenous energies are thought to influence the endogenous energies of the body. The ancient construct of humoral medicine remains a dynamic influence in healthcare. Of great interest to practitioners who would incorporate nutrition and medicinal plants using binary classifications into their therapeutic toolbox, correlations have been made between the energetics of substance and the chemistry of the plants or foods. Taste leads the understanding of pharmacology in many humoral systems. By evaluating the taste of a substance, not only can one understand the qualities of substance, but insight into chemical constituents is also possible. This is one way in which a therapeutic overlap between scientific systems and humoral models exists. A practitioner understanding multiple models of medicine could very likely better serve their patients. By being able to match the qualities of people with the qualities of plants and utilize biochemical understanding, it is possible that further alleviation of suffering and an improvement in health status could be the result. Lastly, I want to address the aspect of plant spirit medicine that has become popular in the last decade or so. Ultimately, plant spirit medicine is about transcending to a pure, consciousness-based connection with nature. One example of this is shamans and adivinos, who operate beyond the chemical understanding of nature and plants. These healers may use entheogens to aid in the transcendence of ordinary consciousness, entheogens being defined as a substance that generates the experience of God or spirit. Such tools as psilocybin or psilocybin in the New Wave pronunciation, ayahuasca, mescaline, sophora, paganum, etc., all can be classified as entheogens. But importantly, I'd like to share an experience I had in the mid-1990s of Don Lupe, an adivino in the Oaxacan Mountains. I arrived there with a wonderful healer by the name of Martha Cecilia, who had an acupuncture license number of 004. We worked together in a children's facility that was largely funded with donations and love from the surrounding community of Cipolite on the coast of Oaxaca, Mexico. Martha Cecilia took me deep into the mountains of Oaxaca, knowing that I was a student and practitioner of herbal medicine, to meet Don Lupe. We drove a very windy and sharp curved, barely paved road that led to a path with enough room to just accommodate my small miniature Ford Bronco. After another 30 minutes on this road, we came to a small village. I remember picking up so many hitchhikers on the way to this small village that the truck was absolutely packed with people. Having a very Westerner perspective as we drove into the village, I wondered, how do these folks possibly get supplies in and out of this mule trail I just drove? I walked into a very small hut, and the second I walked in, my eyes were intensely burning due to the amount of smoke in the air. There was a fire in the middle of the room's dirt floor with very little ventilation out of the room, a practice I have found to be very common in small villages throughout the world. And by now, my lungs were burning and I was stifling a cough. I quickly dropped to my knees, realizing that that was the only way to survive this environment, and finally found a seated position. Martha Cecilia introduced me to Don Lupe, a slender and short indigenous man that looked deeply at peace, but also looked like he wouldn't want to tangle with him. After some conversation, Don Lupe rang a bell to start a ceremony, and the room filled up with villagers. A bowl of psilocybe mushrooms was passed around the room, and I joined the ceremony. Over the evening, I watched a stream of people march in, and Don Lupe worked as a marriage counselor, an exorcist, a predictor of crop health in the upcoming season, and so many different roles. I especially recall being amazed as he threw balls of fire around the room without injuring anyone. At one point, Don Lupe suddenly picked me out of the crowd and intensely stared at me. He finally said, "You know many, many plants." Then he said, "Do you know how we learn the plants?" I said, "No, how do you?" He replied, "The plants tell us how to use them." At that moment, I felt a decade of study drain out my feet. My immediate thought in the moment was, of course, how else would you do it? What a perfect way to understand the truth of plants. It was this experience that deepened my interest in plants, and in entheogens especially, and energy and energetics. It is my belief, as well as many others, that the next major breakthrough in medicine will be in biophysics, the understanding of energy influencing biological systems. For instance, certain cellular receptor systems are now known to respond not only to their ligands, but to electromagnetic pulses. Magnetic fields have been found to have an antidepressant effect. Healers' hands are now known to emit exceptional amounts of electromagnetic energy. In light of these findings and the rate of advancement in the sciences, it seems highly likely that in a few decades, medical scientists will look back with the same conviction of certainty that they cast upon past humoral models and judge the current medical model to be simplistic and misleading. And now let's turn to part two of our excellent interview with Guido Massé.
Kevin, it's also an initiatory experience to realize you're part of something bigger, right? And it gives you a sense of meaning and place. And so it's really, really important, especially in a culture where meaning and place are uncertain and sands shift beneath our feet all the time, to have not only a theoretical touchstone, I am part of something bigger, but one that also includes the practical element, like you just said, plant flowers in your garden. That will do something to save the planet, believe it or not. And it's absolutely true. It's absolutely true. We have the ability to intervene directly. And that's what I really love about herbal medicine, is that it takes this theoretical idea of interconnection. When I talk about being out in right field, I'm unabashedly panpsychist. I think mind exists in everything. Mind is inherent from the very beginning, and so is consciousness. It may not be as complex as ours as a human being's, but it's there at the beginning. Matter and energy are simply the first pattern language used to encode the memory of that consciousness moving through the world, and it just gets more complex from there. So I could definitely get out in right field. But the ultimate point is that we have a real, grounded, physical way to plug into all of this, which is these unhybridized, historically and evolutionarily relevant plants that our culture has encoded the technology of, and we just call that herbal medicine.
Obviously, I'm loving everything you're saying, given the amount I'm talking. Is usually these interviews are, I keep quiet and I let the interviewee talk, but you just said something else that set me off. You know, my viewpoint is similar to yours. I believe that consciousness is the primary substrate of the universe. And when you look at a universe like that, or when you look at a patient like that, you have a very different perspective in how to help people and how to bring them into some sort of homeodynamic resilience, right? Now, you've talked about using psilocybin with patients. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. The use of these really strong consciousness-altering agents from plants or mushrooms is getting a lot of attention. And I don't want to say that it's in any way the bread and butter of my practice or something that I chiefly do, but I have found in certain cases, particularly when, you know, with this awareness of us, you know, myself, the client, the plants that we would consider being part of sort of a shared consciousness that we're developing in our relational process, sometimes we just get stuck, all of us. And it's difficult for us to either move forward or fully grasp all of the threads that are coming into play. And it's at that moment when there's a really clear intent and desire to move forward, but not a ability to sort of get to the root or the clearly articulating thread that might be either responsible for holding things back or be Ariadne's thread to take you out of the labyrinth. When that exists, then I found that these agents can be just the ticket. They are catalysts of change. They throw everything up in the air and let it settle back down again. And most importantly, they take rigid narratives that we might have embedded for whatever reason and soften them so that they can be remolded and they can get into some of the things you were talking about, like synaptic plasticity that occurs as an adolescent is developing. So typically, I like to not start with psilocybin, which is a little more of a commitment. I'll try often to use plants like Salvia divinorum that have a shorter duration of action where it's not a 6 to 8 hour or even longer commitment for the client. What I like about these plants is that they can help bring into focus. First of all, they're challenging, and the challenging experience is actually really important. The challenging experience in and of itself isn't the ticket, though. What needs to happen is that the resolution of the challenge, at least in my opinion, has to come from a letting go rather than an attempt to fix or constrain or, I don't know, all the tools that normally under the light of the sun we bring to bear to our problems, right? Let's analyze it. Let's fix it. Let's do. So it's a training process for dealing with challenge by letting go rather than by plowing through or fixing, which is not necessarily a concept that's familiar to everyone. So first of all, that's a benefit right there. Second of all, being able to soften the rigid narratives that take control of our lives. We're talking about patterns from the outside or the internet controlling us as humans, but our own internal narratives take us on autopilot through a range of different things that sometimes are helpful and sometimes are really not. Softening those then allows me as a practitioner to say things like, you know, you were asking about this particular challenge, like you don't know whether you should continue with this business that you started and whether it's affecting your health and your family's health in a way that is not helpful, but you're also really scared about it. How does that look now, right? Like after we've gone through this experience. And 201 clients tell me that their perspective shifts. Whether it shifts in a way that makes them change their course of action, I'm not sure. But sometimes it certainly does. But the point is that even if it doesn't shift your course of action, the folks with whom I've spoken, with whom I've worked with these plants and mushrooms, tell me that they feel a lot softer and less judgmental to themselves and to others when exploring something like, well, maybe I should have done something different with my life, or maybe I shouldn't have put all my time into this business instead of working with my kid or my partner. And that allows an openness that at the very least helps create a new balance point. So typically that's the reason why I might suggest that a client explore that option for themselves. If the client agrees that that might be an interesting idea, you know, after I share resources with them and they do their own research, then we start the process of making sure that the terrain is ready. It's not something you can just jump into. Very often, especially if we're talking about mental and spiritual health, we need to make sure that the matter, the soma, the basic neuronal tissue, the patterns of tension in the body, all of those have softened to a point where they're ready to receive the medicine and get the benefit from it. So often that means setting the stage with good oil change and an essential fatty acid context, using neurotonic agents like Avena sativa, which is one of my favorites for building nervous system resilience, potentially using adaptogenic herbs if the stress response is still like very out of proportion to the stressor in that individual, maybe even some nervines that are gently relaxing but not sedating. And after we do this for a period of time, you know, you can assess this clinically, whether a person is going to be able to respond with a calmer demeanor to some of the stressors that normally agitated them and sent them into real intense emotional content. If they're responding with a little more calm of a demeanor, then it might be time to start thinking about this ally, whether it be Salvia divinorum, or if they feel comfortable with it and they have some support, a person who could sit with them for 8+ hours, something like psilocybin. The other thing that I always pay attention to if we're going to go in this direction with someone is the debriefing afterwards, to be able to reintegrate the experience into that person's life. And then this idea of thinking about sort of a cyclical pattern moving forward. And this isn't just something that I use in my clinical practice with psychedelics, though I think that the use of nootropics and psychedelics and adaptogens in the context of exercise and sports physiology from an herbal medicine perspective taught me that you can't just start taking one herb and take it every day for the rest of your life. There often are cycles that we need to mind and pay attention to, and shifting the herbal protocol during those cycles at different points can really help us maximize the long-term benefit and outcome. So, you know, I hinted at it a little bit. When working with psychedelics, there's sort of that pre-laying down of the foundation, which is largely nutritional and tonic. And then afterwards, there can be either a nootropic or a strong nervine-based component to help reintegrate the lessons of the experience into your life so that that softening can occur, so that that greater degree of mental and physiologic flexibility can come into play, so that people can practice that based on their intention. And sometimes you need a little bit of help, whether it's an aromatherapy spritzer or a cup of linden tea during the day, because your intention was to like not freak out and get defensive when your partner brings up certain issues, right? You realize that that was really important during your psychedelic session, but maybe now you just need a little bit of something to soften the edges during the day so you can follow through on that. And then, you know, things might stabilize or they might start to drift again. And one of the places where I saw this most clearly was when we would do what I call the GI tract reset for folks, which sometimes is another important piece before doing psychedelic therapy. You're maybe able to use agents like golden seal or black walnut to correct an imbalance in the microbial content of the small intestine. And you also adjust the diet to do that. You heal the mucous membrane of the GI tract in whatever way is appropriate for that client. They start to feel a lot better. They can tolerate a wider diversity of foods. And their mood also shifts, right? As we know, because of the connection between microbiome, the GI tract, the enteroendocrine nature of the GI tract, and our brain and blood-brain barrier, etc. But after a period of time, whether it's the stressors of life, the necessity of our daily work life, or the junk that the American food industry attempts to shove into us on a daily basis, things will shift back into, you know, a pattern that is similar to what it was before. Maybe not exactly the same, but still. And the question becomes, how do I help empower the client to recognize these shifts when they're happening so that they can start going back to the previous stage of the cycle with the herbs they know and love and have already used? and repeat that cycle, but sort of at a different level. And I see the same thing with psychedelic therapy. If folks end up resonating with a particular ally, whether it be salvia divinorum or psilocybin, some folks are into ayahuasca, others will use agents like LSD. Ayahuasca is not something I have experience with, but for some folks, it seems to be really helpful. They'll recognize when things are starting to shift in their physiology, and they will recognize that maybe it's time to repeat that original cycle that we went through. And so sometimes I'll be called on to kind of help walk them through that again. But after a couple of times, people generally recognize what the plan is, at least how it applies to them, and are able to sort of pursue that tonic nutritional strategy first, pay attention to their gut or whatever system in their body might need a little love, then have their ceremony with their ally, process through it. Maybe we'll have a conversation after that, and we'll be able to pick and choose some herbal allies that aren't psychedelics, but that can help hold their hand as they try to really instantiate that experience to bring it into physical reality, into their life, and into their mind and consciousness.
Guido, really well said. I think you've just given all the clinicians listening out there a 30,000-foot plan on how to actually do clinical work. Let me just say that the way that I would sum it up, the way that I used to think about it in clinical practice, good clinical practice is helping patients see choices that they couldn't see previously. And I think that's what you've just described, is helping people see options that they couldn't see.
That's right. And in the best case scenario, we identify those options together and we try some different things to meet those needs and we co-create that plan. And eventually, I'm not really necessary anymore unless something new comes out on the horizon.
I love what you said too about herbs have cycles in people's lives. I think any herbalist that is actually practicing and uses herbs regularly has found that on their own. But yet I see a lot of herbalists still pushing the same herb on people over and over and over, which is unfortunate.
Yeah. And I mean, that might be appropriate in certain cases, but I think that's also an artifact of our modern drug-based culture, which tends to monopopularize things, look for silver bullets, you know, the whole deal. But I think the cycle thing is important. And I guess I'll just leave it there.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. Given that you've just given all the clinicians listening a really incredible viewpoint in terms of how to successfully practice clinically, something I definitely jive with in terms of what I was doing when I was practicing regularly, is there anything else you want to add to clinicians using herbs in their practice? By the way, a lot of our clinicians are actually MDs. So what would you say to the MD who wanted to embrace herbal medicines in their clinical practice?
I don't know that I feel like I can have too much to offer other than saying how appreciative I am for MDs who are looking to integrate herbal medicine into their practice. It wasn't necessarily a given 20 years ago when we started the Sage Mountain Free Herbal Clinic. So I'm so grateful in seeing that in medical students who are moving through like the University of Vermont Medical School here. The level of interest that I feel comes from a sense of compassion and caring for their patients. And anyway, I'm just really appreciative of that. And then I guess I would say that, you know, the tools of modern medicine are fantastic and it's important to have them available. I feel like the reliance on those tools as a first-line intervention can decrease if folks are interested in using herbal medicines in their practice. And I would encourage the study and use of tonics, the idea that we can improve and optimize with some degree of specificity different multi-organ, multi-function parts of the human being using these tonics, whether they be adaptogens or neurotonics, or some of our polyphenolic gene expression and epigenetic regulators. They work so very differently from the tools of modern medicine that you rarely see overly dramatic herb-drug interactions, first of all. So that checks one box right there. But secondly, everything we've talked about in terms of establishing a greater degree of resonance with the homeodynamic processes in which we as individuals are nested, affecting our culture and our mind one individual at a time, improving our appreciation and joy of the world around us. That's what these tonics do. So rather than finding a substitute for an SSRI in the form of a strong hypericum extract, which certainly may be appropriate in certain clinical cases. Developing a relationship with rose and linden and milky oats and some of these tonics that slowly over time create a different microenvironment inside that human being, I think would be my suggestion as a place to start with herbal medicine. It's both the safest and in the long run, believe it or not, I think the area that you'll appreciate the most.
Thank you for that. Yeah. Shifting the informational flow or thinking about molecular messengers moving through the system from a food source or a medicinal plant source rather than strictly from a pharmacological source, I think is one of the things I heard you say.
And I think, Kevin, we're going to see this more and more, but cutting edge medical science, which medical science is never cutting edge, I think in part because, you know, we're really conservative and rightly so. So some of the concepts that we're talking about in realms of physics and information theory are going to take a while to get down to medicine, but they should and they will is the point. And herbal medicine has that tech. We just use really weird words to talk about it. Those words sound more like a weather report than they do a cybernetic description of homeodynamic systems working far from equilibrium as like super efficient dissipative structures. But that's essentially what we are, right? And if you want to just take it down really simply, you know, we're a lot like gardeners and organic gardeners at that, or even better, biodynamic gardeners, right? Who are paying attention to the health of the soil and the environment rather than applying a targeted pesticide or herbicide designed to address one tiny piece of the system. And if you start from a place of respect and trust for the living system and focusing on things like support over control, you'll find that your tools that you need to control an acute situation at any given moment will A, not be as necessary as often, and B, work better in the context of a system that is resilient enough to handle it and exhibit perhaps even fewer side effects when you do need to use that acute use modern medical tool.
Beautifully stated. Guido Massé, thank you so much for joining us. I hope you'll come back in the future.
Kevin, thanks again for inviting me. I hope you are well and you stay safe. It's been really a great pleasure to talk to you. And again, I feel like of like mind with you.